Welcome to this week's episode of Research Goes Viral. My name is Stephen Devlin. I am one of your hosts for today with the amazing...
Anna Sims.
And also the incredible Professor Wendy Barclay, CBE, is joining us here today. Not only are you a CBE, you're also the 11th annual winner of the Sir Michael Stoker Award.
I am. Thank you very much for the nomination and the award. It's wonderful.
Congratulations. And for those that don't know, the Sir Michael Stoker Award is an award that is delivered to a prestigious virologist that is voted for by the PGRs, postdocs, technicians of the Centre for Virus Research here at the University of Glasgow. And you're invited to give us a little talk, which will be later on today. Yep. But for now, we're going to ask you some questions about your career. Before we get into the questions, we're just going to do a quick backstory for you. I've done a lot of research. So you graduated from the University of Cambridge with a BA in Natural Sciences.
That's right.
Before moving on to a PhD at the Common Cold Unit in Salisbury. Yes. And that was with Dr. David Tyrrell and Dr. Fred Brown.
Yes.
I believe. Yep. This is all panning out well. We've got it all correct so far.
Yes.
You then moved on to your first postdoc with Professor Jeff Almond at the University of Reading, which was looking at poliovirus replication.
Yes.
With a second postdoc with Dr. Peter Plaisy over at Mount Sinai Medical Center in New York, and that was looking at influenza stuff, where you developed the influenza B reverse genetic system.
I did, yes.
Perfect. We're doing so far. So far, so good. You then moved back to the University of Reading in 1995 to open up your own research group. Yep. I think they were still continuing to look at influenza B at that time.
Yeah, influenza B, first of all, and then moved gradually towards influenza A.
And then in 2007, you made a slight move to Imperial College London, still continuing the same sort of work, looking at influenza A, that kind of thing, and more recently with some work on SARS-CoV-2, given recent events.
That's right.
And then in 2022, you're awarded the CBE. Yes. And then in 2023, you're awarded, of course, the most prestigious, the Sir Michael Stoker Award.
Absolutely. Yes, absolutely.
In that time, you've done many other things. You've chaired a few things. You were chair of virology for the Microbiology Centre. You're currently the chair for the Action Medical Research, chair of virology. And you've been on various committees and various editors of editorial boards for journals.
You've been extremely busy.
Very busy.
I think it's good to keep challenging yourself, and it's good to take on some new roles. And some of the things I do now, if I'm totally honest, maybe are not as enjoyable as just being in the lab or talking to my PhD students, but I think you do have to give some back as well. You know, I've benefited hugely over the years from mentorship, from other people, also from being awarded grants. And so, you know, at some stage you need to step up and sit on those boards and think about, you know, which grant's going to get awarded. And that's kind of the stage that I'm at now.
Yeah, all about feeding back in, I guess.
Yeah. Well, you've done a lot of things, as we've just said. But one of the things that I noticed most strikingly about looking through your work is, and we briefly just talked about this during the Q&A session, is the breadth of topics and things that you've worked on. So again, looking at your website on the Imperial College London website, I think you summarize it as respiratory viruses, cellular molecular modes of pathogenesis, transmissibility, and host range restrictions, which in itself is quite a broad range. But how would you describe in a paragraph, shall we say, because I don't think a sentence is going to cover it, but how would you describe what it is that you work on?
I mean, these days my big question is, like many people, is around pandemics. I mean, I think at the heart of it, I am most interested in why do some animal viruses successfully cross into people and spark pandemics? How does that actually happen? And I don't really mean in terms of the environment where it happens. I mean in terms of the molecular virology. But having said that, of course, over the years, what I've learned is that, you know, these things are multifaceted, and understanding all the aspects are interesting. So most of what we do in my lab now in terms of research is around that. But it does span then all the way from understanding the particular amino acids in the influenza polymerase, which change its interaction with a host factor, which is important in species specificity, all the way to looking at transmission in animal or even human models, because transmission is really important in whether or not a virus is going to go pandemic. And in the middle there are the sort of mitigations as well. You know, what are the antivirals? What are the vaccines? What are the diagnostics? How are we using them? And would they prevent that happening or help us deal with it better? So it is all around nowadays mm-hmm. for me, the sort of pandemic prediction and response. But as you say, over the years, I've looked at things and collaborated with people from so many angles. And I think my weakness actually is being too broad. Mm-hmm. But, you know, with another hat on, I think that does sometimes make me valuable on committees and things because I've had a sort of fairly broad look at the entire spectrum of the subject.
Mm-hmm. And also you can look at it from lots of different angles and different approaches to the same question.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like sometimes if you're too specified, you get kind of stuck in a academic way of thinking associated with that area.
Yeah.
So I think it's quite nice to have a breadth.
Yes.
But how did you go about building that kind of career, or did it kind of happen to you?
I think these things just happen. I mean, I think it is about being open-minded and responding to people. So as I was saying just a few minutes ago, you know, one of the great things that happened to me early in my career when I was starting my own group was that I attended a conference, presented a poster about the sort of work I was interested in doing, and Maria Zambon came up to me, and she had just become the head of the virus respiratory unit at Colindale, the Public Health England, as it was, UK HSA as it is now, and really sort of just reached out and said, you know, we should work together. I've got all these amazing clinical samples, and I'm on the coalface of the real world, and you've got the capability to do, you know, these new techniques like reverse genetics and molecular virology, and I think that by teaming up, we could do really well. And one of my previous mentors, Jeff Armand, who was my first postdoc supervisor, I know that he'd done really well doing that because, you know, the way that he applied the sequencing that he'd done by combining with Phil Miner, who was at the NIBSC at the time and saw the problems with poliovirus vaccine reversion, they realised that by working together, Phil had the right samples and Jeff had the right techniques to really solve a proper real-world problem.
Uh-huh.
And so I'd had that model in the back of my mind, and when Maria came up and said, let's do that, that was great. But that has happened to me from other people over the years as well. I've been very lucky. Sometimes I've reached out to people. So in the early days of trying to think about using the right cell systems to grow respiratory viruses, we read a paper from the University of North Carolina where they were developing these three-dimensional ALI differentiated cells. And we just wrote and we said, look, you know, we're virologists and we think this could be a great way of studying respiratory viruses. And, you know, Ray Pickles, who's now a long-term friend, you know, wrote back and said, yeah, come over, let's do it, you know. So it was just about making those interactions with people, and of course sometimes you write and people don't respond, so that's also how it happens, you know. It's about people at the end of the day, you finding the people you can work with, and your career sort of then follows, I think, those successful interactions.
So about being open-minded and listening and interacting with other experts in the field.
Absolutely. No, I think really it's about recognising what you can't do on your own and where you do need to reach out and work. And those always bring added benefits. And, you know, I'm very lucky now that we, you know, we've put together these consortia. We've got the G2P too. And I think that's a very similar model. You know, we realised in COVID that as the variants arose that I think no one UK institute or lab on its own was going to make much of a big impact. But if we combined forces, we could work together and do something. But actually what I've learned is that not only that, but I think in these consortia, they're really beneficial for the early careers researchers involved because they get exposed to lots of different PIs with lots of different attitudes and ways of working, as well as knowing each other and reaching out. I know, you know, now the whole thing runs basically at the level of the postdocs and the students who WhatsApp each other and exchange things. And that's great, you know, and that's how it should absolutely be. So, you know, just widening your networks and combining forces, particularly in today, it's competitive, but also it's, you know, technology is moving at such a pace. You can't be an expert in everything and you need to do what you can and contribute to the bigger.
A related question, do you have any collaboration tips for people trying to reach out and form these kind of connections?
Yeah, I mean, I think definitely don't be scared to just email or whichever is your preferred way of, you know, even phone people up or whatever. Go up to people at conferences, put yourself out there. obviously you do have to have a bit of humility, because not everybody, you know, wants to work with you if you're going to, so you need to be upfront with it and sort of right from the start say this can be a co-authorship, you know, well, mm-hmm, you know, yeah. you need to be clear, I think, about what you're asking for, yeah, and how it's going to work, and then that way things don't go wrong a bit later on.
Yeah.
But I think it's always beneficial, and also, you know, sometimes just to recognize people are really busy. Mm. I think one or two follow-up emails is okay. After that, probably you get the message that, you know, they're working on this with someone else or something, and they don't want to do this, and that's okay too. You know, it's you find your way.
Yeah.
Thank you
so much for giving us that advice for collaboration, because you know have collaborated with a lot of people over the years, and I think that's what. It's part of why you are the prominent virologist that you are, is that you're so involved in so many different projects and so many different stories. And that's part of what this Sir Michael Stoker Award is awarded for, is to a prominent virologist who, you know, is out there doing the thing and making a difference. But one question that I think for us, because we are both, you were just about to submit, I'm in my third year, we're both, you know, PhDs, soon to be postdoc. I've got a while left. But so what for you was the biggest stage in your career that had the biggest learning curve? Mm. You know?
Yeah, I mean, I thought, woolly answer. I mean, I think they're all learning curves, right? Mm. And I think it's important to recognise that and be kind to yourself. And you know, when you become a PhD student, that's a big step change. You are now planning your life, your work, and there's a lot of papers to read and mm-hmm. managing time. You know, when you become a postdoc, I think there's quite a lot of learning required about how to manage your supervisor, perhaps even more so than when you're a PhD. Mm-hmm. And a PhD, there's quite a lot written, I think, for PhD students now about the supervisor-student relationship, and there's a lot of thought given to that. I think with postdocs, it's still a tricky time, and I know as a supervisor, I can be very demanding on my postdocs and expect them to do an awful lot and to supervise the students, but also churn out their own data and mm-hmm. things. And so I think, you know, and they need to keep on top of stuff as well and begin mm-hmm. this reaching out and making their own collaborations as well. Yeah, so I think there's, you know, that's a transition phase. And then obviously when you start writing your own grants, mm-hmm. again, really important to not do it all on your own. I mean, you never submit a grant that nobody else has read. Right. I mean, you need 2, 3, 4 people to read it. And then if you get an interview for a fellowship, I mean, at Imperial, you know, we now rehearse people 5, 6 times. I think that's a bit too much myself. Oh. But, you know, 2 or 3 rehearsals. So, you know, everything in life is about preparation there. Mm-hmm. And then, as I've said, you know, you then go through your career. You're always learning. There's always challenges. Nowadays, the way we teach is completely different than the way we used mm-hmm. to. There's a lot of flip learning, there's a lot of small classes, and actually you have to relearn it all or mm-hmm. keep on top of it or see good practice, pick up tips for how you see other people teaching and you see the students responding well to that. Mm-hmm. I'd like to do it that way around. I'll think of turning, so my lecture to our master's class next week, you know, in the years gone by, I've given them, you know, 55 slides in 60 minutes of blah, blah, blah. I think I'm just going to say to them, you know, tell me what the next pandemic's going to be and why, and then let's have a discussion.
Yeah,
because I think it's just so much more enjoyable. It's more like the sort of old-fashioned tutorials, in a sense, which I think people get a lot from.
Yeah.
And they can all go and watch my lectures on YouTube or what these days, so they don't need me doing that for them. Uh-huh. So I think there's all that, you know, every phase of your career, there's a new challenge and a new thing to learn. Mm-hmm. And I don't think any one is more crucial than another. I think what's important is that you actually recognize, mm-hmm. don't stop learning. Don't stop challenging yourself and trying something new.
Yeah. I think also, like, maybe not looking too far ahead too soon. Yeah. And that's where, like, imposter syndrome stuff really comes in.
Oh, yeah.
Like, I should be coming up with ideas. I should have, you know, and let it grow, I guess. I don't know if you agree with that.
I totally agree. Be kind to yourself. Do what you do at the stage you're at.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, make sure you're challenging yourself. Mm-hmm. That doesn't necessarily mean that you're going to write the perfect fellowship application next week, but certainly you could go and you know, ask for help again is what's important. Go and discuss with people, try out ideas. One of the things I love that we do here, and I'm do at Imperial, and I'm sure you do here, is if people's got quite an early idea, we have a lunch, invite people and do almost like a chalkboard session. You know, I'm thinking of this, here's the background, what do you think? And that's, you know, that's what we love, isn't it? That's a scientist. Try out an idea, does it work, or is there a flaw here, and how would you do it? And
like really casual, informal idea exchange.
Absolutely. And you have to do that before you put anything down on a piece of paper. Uh-huh. Just check out your idea works. Otherwise, you know, I've seen people have written pages and pages of fellowship applications, and in the first few lines you can see, oh, you know, this has been done, or it's not going to work, or something. Yeah. So really important to just, you know, build that up by reaching out to people. And as I say, I think that you'll find that certainly PIs or people who've been through it already, they really enjoy that exercise as well. Mm-hmm, so it's enjoyable for everybody, or beneficial for everybody.
No, yeah, I agree. And I think during the pandemic, when we were really working in small teams, isolated, and in here we couldn't work multiple people in the same lab, so I took the night shift. It was crazy. But we lost a lot of that informal chat.
Yes, and
I think it was hard to build that back up.
And I think especially if you're early career, you sometimes think if you present an idea that it has to be concrete
polished and
you know, ironclad and all the rest of it.
Yeah.
But having that informal setting where it's coffee or it's, you know, as I say, getting around the blackboard and having a you know, quick chat about it, it gets you used to that idea of rebuttal and refinement and
absolutely.
Presenting
No, really important.
Here's my fault.
You know, this isn't quite right, but let's modify it.
Yeah.
That's not a rejection, it's not a failure, it's actually a success.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
you know, you've ended up better.
Yeah.
I think creating spaces for that kind of informal chat as well. Like, one of the first conferences I ever presented at was the influenza update meeting conferences that we have in the UK. Mm-hmm. And my supervisor Ed made it very clear that it was an informal space. It's a bring your ideas chat. And I was, you know, 8 months into my PhD, 6 months of it was a pandemic. And it was not my best presentation. But the influenza community is quite open, I find, and quite helpful in that way. What has your experience been like with specifically the flu community in the UK, but broader virology community?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a lot better now than it used to be. I think that's the case across all of virology and probably all science, if we're honest. I think that the days have gone where labs had, you know, fences around them and you shouldn't share things and it was all about them. There's a, you know, people really have realized that sharing data is beneficial for everybody, and you still get your paper out and it's fine.
Bioarchive and sharing stuff before.
The whole mentality around this has changed, and so I agree that, I mean, I think the influenza update meetings, I mean, again, that sprang out of something that we started doing with sort of some London labs and Cambridge and Oxford, and it grew into a more of a community. But they were always very, very informal, and it was a group of people of sort of my generation, a few 10 years or more ago now, that sort of had grown up, if you like, as more friends than competitors, and so saw the benefits of sharing. And many of the people in our labs had been trained in a different lab and then come across, so that also helps. So I think where you have that nice community, I think that the update meetings are really good. I'm not sure yet that that's the case everywhere you go. I mean, I think the United States still is potentially a little bit more barriered than the UK has become, and I think, you know, that can partly be down to the way funding works as well. So a lot of these things are shaped, it's not really, let's say, the fault of individuals, but sort of the ecology of the whole
policy level, kind of publish or perish kind of situation.
And I think, you know, we're trying to get away from all of that, you know, with DORA and all of these other things that are along. But you need to sort of build, if you like, encourage what the alternatives are then, and make it very obvious the benefits to sort of coax people out from their castles.
Yeah, don't be so worried, it's fine.
Well, I suppose that kind of touches on another thing that comes with the Sir Michael Stoker Award, is, again, it's about science communication and open science and things like that. So I just, and you've kind of touched on it there, open science between like labs and sharing of data, and you know, if we pool our resources, we can, you know, hopefully do more than what we can individually. Mm. So I kind of feel, as we're getting more and more open about science, we are seeing some pushback from the general public, especially during COVID. So I just wanted to get some of your thoughts on how, because a lot of the work you do is on like pandemic preparedness. So, you know, if you were to put it under an umbrella, it might be under that. Mm-hmm. How do you feel like we could go forward with being able to almost prevent the sort of pushback that happened during COVID?
You've hit what I think is our key challenge as virologists. I've done a lot of science communication in the past, and in the pandemic of swine flu, I call it swine flu, I shouldn't really, but PH1N1 I did lots of TV, radio, you know, wrote some articles for newspapers and things like that. And I think that's interesting because at that time, I feel that overall, the public were welcoming of the information. I think that we have to learn to get the balance right between how to tell the public the information that they want. And I mean, the biggest challenge that's different, I think, now from 2009 is social media and the propagation, if you like, of false science by apparently trusted people with huge numbers of followers. And I mean, I think, you know, this is a subject way beyond my own capabilities, but it's something that we have to really engage with behavioural scientists and people who are trying to work on this from a sort of academic's not quite the word, but you know, come at this with a robust, intelligent response to this, because it is going to be so unfortunate and dangerous for us. The only way I think to do that is to keep communicating outwardly. We can't stop. We probably have to these days be quite careful about the words and what we say. And I don't mean by not saying the truth, but I think that we must be careful not to be alarmist. I think, again, going back to maybe it's the funding system or maybe it's a sort of ethos, but there are certain scientists from the United States, for example, who will announce a finding or write a paper or put a bioarchive preprint in a way which is using quite inflammatory words or quite alarmist words. And of course the media will pick up on that, and of course they will make a story from it. The journalist's job is to make a story which sells newspapers or whatever it is these days. And then that is then further propagated in even worse ways by the social media platform. The Science Media Centre, who I've worked with over the years, are fantastic. And they really, really help. And I think we have to even push them a bit further on this area and really say, how are we going to, if you like, solve or tackle this social media problem so that we can, you know. So I think where the Science Media Centre are great is that they will pair us with trusted science journalists in particular, who work for the newspapers or for the television or for the radio, and that's good. And while scientists' voices are being heard in those formats through a trusted scientific journalist, we're still out there in the public's mind as being open and honest people.
So again, it's about collaboration and playing to your strengths.
Yeah, definitely.
You know, scientists at the bench may not have the right media training to announce stuff to the world like
So it's, I mean, you know, the people at the Science Media Centre, Fiona Fox, Fiona Lethbridge, and the other fantastic people who are there, you know, if you're at all worried about what you're going to do, you can run it by them, or you can ask them how best to do this. And I know we all have press offices here as well in universities and centres now who are also fantastic. And I run it by everybody. I mean, the Science Media Centre know the press offices as well. But, you know, if there's something coming out, let's immediately tell them what's coming out. I mean, last year we had a paper which I absolutely love, and I'm not going to talk about today, which is our gene-edited chickens, you know, trying to make chickens which are resistant to flu. That's a pretty controversial area, and how to explain that to the public. There's a lot of interest from journalists and the media on that. But really, the press offices and the Science Media Centre were fantastic in helping us sort of think ahead of how to put a press release out before the paper was published, and how to, you know, to clearly explain what we were doing and why, and acknowledge the caveats and the issues rather than being caught out about them by someone else. Just be open. Say, look, this isn't perfect yet. There are problems. This virus seems to escape this particular strategy, and we've got to work now. And really important that we acknowledge that, because we know there are other people around the world who are perhaps doing similar experiments and aren't necessarily acknowledging it. So let's shout that out too.
Yeah, I think that's the thing.
Stand up and say, do it right, you know?
Not leaving the public in a vacuum where they can kind of
pick up on the wrongness.
If you're giving the public, you know, the information that they want and that they need, but clearly and scientifically correct, then
honesty is absolutely critical here.
For sure. A little bit of change of tact. In your interview for the Microbiology Prize Medal, you talked a little bit about the gender gap that appears between postdoc and PI.
Yeah.
But the Sir Michael Stoker Award is an early career research PhD postdoc award. Mm. So I wanted to know, you talked about kind of the policy changes that can be made to support women in academia, but I was wondering if you had any advice for women during the transitional point so that they can advocate better for themselves, for the actual women that are trying to progress.
Yeah, I mean, I think this is getting better, I must say. I mean, even in the last few years, every year I think we're seeing changes, and I'm so heartened there's now so many fantastic early career PIs, particularly in our area of virology, coming through and making that transition. You know, advocating, I think we have to, you know, we have to still keep just doing what we do and showing that it's successful. Mm-hmm. I mean, the best thing you can do is be the role model and show it's possible. That takes a lot of strength. I know, you know, you get your first PI job, and then, you know, things may happen to you in life. You may have children, or it may be something else that happens. Again, this is a bit about the research ecology and the research environment. It's about being the sort of person that's not afraid to ask for help. Mm-hmm. You know, that help is there, and if it isn't, it should be. Mm-hmm. And so just keep asking until you find the person that recognises that the help should be there, mm-hmm. and acknowledges it and will help you. Uh-huh. It may be the first person that you ask doesn't get it. But I think what women have to do for themselves is keep at it, and I know it's tiring, and I know it's hard. Actually, you know, there are many other groups, it's not just women. Other people, it could be that you've got a sick person in your family you need to care for. It could be that your ethnic background makes life more difficult for you. Who knows what it is, but we should not tolerate a world which doesn't have a route to help you have exactly the same opportunities for your career as somebody who didn't particularly have those problems. And so I think it is about just keep going. Uh-huh. And, you know, Ray, I'm really heartened. I know here at CVR, you know, you have committees. We have our People and Culture Committee at my department at Imperial, and then many layers above that to feed up. Mm-hmm. And get on those committees if you can, and have the energy. And if you haven't got the energy to be on the committee, at least tell them your story. Mm-hmm. You know, share it so that someone else can fight that fight for you, because they want to. The people who volunteer to be on those committees, that's what they're there for. And that's maybe what they can really contribute and feel good about doing. So let them. Yeah.
Perfect. That's great advice. Now we are running very short of time, but I really want to add this question because it's very fun. It's a fun
it's
little
a question
at the end.
To end.
So it's about the burden of knowledge. With knowledge comes a burden.
Yes.
So I really dislike the fact that helicopter breaks down into helicopter. That really upsets me, like in a linguistic point of view. It really upsets me. Anna, what's your fact that you dislike?
I came across a paper where butterflies remember what happened to them as a caterpillar, even though they go through like the liquefied phase.
They become soup for 2 weeks. So
it's horrendous, and I don't want to know it, and I think about it all the time.
Oh, gosh.
Is there any fun facts that you wish you didn't know, like fun dinner party facts that you're like, I don't agree with that?
Oh gosh, you really.
It's such an odd question, but we just thought.
Just like,
yeah.
I think.
Oh, I'm gonna really struggle now to think of one.
I think about the soup all the time.
The soup gets to me.
And Stephen wrote it down on the thing, and I was reminded of it all over again.
Yeah, oh gosh, I'm going to fail this. Don't worry. I'm just going to really struggle. I'm trying to think, what do I know that I wish I didn't know? No, I'm struggling. Okay. And I'm
happy to know everything. You know, that's all good. The other one that gets
me. That's great. But all of the knowledge that you have is
not
good.
Disturbing.
Yeah. Doesn't keep you up at night. That's good.
No, I don't. I don't think. You know, to be honest, you know, I know what you're saying about the caterpillars. But you just turn that around. Actually, how?
It's cool.
But
that is just amazing. And I do feel slightly sorry for the caterpillars or the butterflies that they become.
Yes.
I know.
But I still think that's a bit of knowledge that we sort of need to know, because maybe we need to be a bit kinder to the butterflies.
I know,
right, new paper 2020. But no, that is everything from us.
Yeah.
So thank you very much for sitting down with us today.
Thank you for having me.
Where would you like people to find you? Are you on Twitter or website or anything like that?
I am on Twitter, but since it became X, I haven't really done it. Yeah. And also, I did find in COVID, Twitter became a bit much and took over my life a little bit.
Yeah.
So the best way to find me is just to drop me an email. Mm. You know, I have one email account, it's for everything, and I hope that I respond. So reach me, email, or give me a call.
Perfect, and we'll put those in the description of this video below.
Yeah.
If you want to find me, I'm on Twitter/X at sdevlinbio.
I'm also on Twitter as Anna Sims Bio.
Perfect. Well, thank you very much for watching, listening, all those things. And once again, congratulations, Professor Wendy Barclay, CUE, 11th annual winner of the Sir Michael Stroker Award.
Thank you very much.
Perfect. Thank you.
Thank you.